black round spot, and that is all. And such a speck our Earth would be if he who looks upon the stars through the red atmosphere of Mars could see our little creeping ball across the disk of crimson crawl, as I our sister planet see. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, home of the Cronin Observatory in London, Ontario, Canada. Our opening quote tonight comes from the 19th century poet Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., on the occasion of his observation of the transit of Venus across the solar disk in 1882. These transits are actually quite rare, coming in pairs spaced more than a century apart. In fact, this coming transit will only be the seventh such transit for which our science has given us prior knowledge about when to look sunward. If you can observe it, you will be in good company, as astronomer David Levy remarked in 2004, the transit is a chance to stand beside Edmund Halley and James Cook and take a dip into the magic waters of astronomical history. But such events don't just link us to the past, they also evoke the future. The next transit won't come before 2117. The astronomer, William Harkness, had this to say as he stood at the start of that yawning 121.5-year gap. We are now on the eve of the second transit of a pair, after which there will be no other till the 21st century of our era has dawned upon the Earth. When the last transit season occurred, the intellectual world was awakening from the slumber of ages, and that wondrous scientific activity which has led to our present advanced knowledge was just beginning. What will be the state of science when the next transit season arrives? Not even our children's children will live to take part in the astronomy of that day. As for ourselves, we will have to do with the present. Now, that sense of here and now, of presence in the cosmic sense, was emphasized by the editorial board of the New York Times in the aptly titled article, A Stroll Across the Sun. About such astronomical events, they wrote, "They occur for reasons that have everything to do with our location in space and in time as observers. And yet, their great merit is that they cause us to lift our heads from our own sober planet to remember the solar system and the galaxy and the universe to which we belong." Guiding us through this rare celestial occurrence, we have an interview tonight with Dave McCarter, past president and outreach coordinator for the London chapter of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. In 2004, Dave observed the transit of Venus from the island of Crete and plans to observe this year's recurrence on the Big Island of Hawaii. If you're thinking of heading out yourself, Dave has some tips for observing, which he shared recently with our own Alyssa Gilbert. Transitioning us on our journey tonight is none other than Charles Dutroit's musical interpretation of Gustav Holst's Venus. Enjoy!
Well, thank you, Dave, for being here with us today.
You're welcome.
So there is this very cool event coming up on June 5th, which is the transit of Venus.
That's right.
So before we talk about the specific event that's coming up on the 5th, maybe you could tell us a bit about the history of Venus transits in general.
Well, as you know, Earth goes around the sun in a year, and Venus speeds around the sun a little bit faster because it's closer to the sun. Right now, if you look out in the western sky after sunset, you'll see brilliant Venus. And it's getting ready to come once again between the Earth and the Sun. And one might think, okay, that happens every couple of years. It's pretty frequent. And while Venus goes between us and the Sun, maybe we should see it going across the face of the Sun. The weird thing is that that really didn't occur to anybody for thousands of years. And then Johannes Kepler, who is really famous for figuring out a lot of orbits back in 1627, he calculated that Venus would actually go across the face of the Sun. So he seems to be the first to realize that that was actually a possibility. And he calculated that would occur in 1631. But A, his calculations were a little bit rough. B, nobody knew exactly when it would occur. And so apparently nobody was watching. So that particular transit wasn't observed. There's a possibility that somebody previous looking up at the Sun, maybe on a very cloudy day, might have seen the little speck that is Venus going across the bigger disk of the Sun, but it's not recorded in history. So it was Kepler, really, who said, hold on, this is possible. You know, then there was another fellow, Jeremiah Horlocks from Manchester, England, who sat down and restudied Kepler's calculations and realized that another transit was going to come up. That was in 1639. About 8 years after Kepler's transit. It was a December transit, and he did manage to observe it. It was a really close thing because he was a deacon of a church. He had church duties that afternoon. He set up a simple telescope, just a single lens, aimed it to the south. That cast an image of the Sun on a piece of paper at some distance inside his room. And he kind of moved the paper across the room during the day. Of course, this is December in England. So the Sun's really low in the sky. It was kind of cloudy at one part in the day. He had to go off to his duties. When he got back, he went into the house in a hurry, moved his little piece of paper, and saw that Venus was already on the disk. And so he was really the first to observe the transit of Venus, the shadow, basically, of Venus against the face of the Sun. A friend of his, William Crabtree, also in England, also happened to see it. And then a weird thing happens. Venus and Earth are synchrally locked, more or less. Their orbits are tied together in a very weird relationship. And we do about 143 years to every one of Venus's 280 orbits or some number like that. You can look it up on Wikipedia and get the exact numbers. But the point is that there's a pattern wherein Venus goes across the Sun. The latest one was in 2004, June the 8th. The next one is this year. That's 8 years apart. And then nothing happens. Venus is going by the Earth, by the Sun from Earth. But because of a slight tilt in Venus's orbit, Venus is either above the Sun or below the Sun, maybe just missing the Sun. Maybe one of our spacecraft in Earth orbit could spot the transit of Venus, but we can't from the surface of Earth. And then after 105 and a half years, the Venus transits the Sun again. It's a really amazing coincidence that this even happens at all. You have to be in exactly the right spot. So 105 and a half years and then 121 and a half years. That's a long time to wait. The next transit is going to be in 2117, in December.
So I guess that's why one's so special, is because really everyone who's alive right now probably isn't going to be around for another Venus transit.
That's a fair assumption. Yeah. I regard myself as lucky that I was able to see the last transit in 2004, and I was rather keen on that transit because I knew that it hadn't happened since 1882. I thought, wow, there's nobody alive who's seen a transit of Venus. I would kind of like to be able to say that I've seen a transit of Venus. And then looking into it, I discovered that if I stayed here in London with the vagaries of the cloud that we get, I might not see it at all. So I wanted to go somewhere where I was pretty much guaranteed a clear sky. And I also wanted to go to somewhere where I could see the whole transit from beginning to end. Now, it takes 5.5 to 6.5 hours, and the most exciting parts are as the transit first begins, and you're looking at this big disk of the Sun, hopefully through a number 14 welder's glass or a solar safe filter, a telescope that's got a proper solar filter on it, or maybe even a solar scope, a hydrogen alpha scope would be nice. And you're looking at this disk of the Sun, even though you studied all that diagrams, you're not exactly sure where that first little bite out of the sun takes place. So you're going to watch the sun. Suddenly there's this little nip, and that's Venus coming out of the face of the sun. I thought that'd be really, really exciting. And we were going to go somewhere in Europe to see it. So we eventually decided upon Crete because it's in the middle of the Mediterranean and a pretty dry place, especially in June. Got up early, got the telescope set up. I had a little portable telescope and a solar filter. I got it tracking on the sun and waited and waited and waited. And the appointed time came and went, and I still didn't see anything. And it wasn't for about another minute and a half that I began to suddenly realize there was this persistent little bite out of the edge of the sun. That was pretty exciting. Now, a lot of people would go, well, it wouldn't be as exciting as the Maple Leafs winning the Stanley Cup, and I have to agree with that.
Well, that's not going to happen in anyone's lifetime either.
Oh, that's right. Well, I do remember the last time it happened. But
in 67,
it was a long time ago. So it's a rare event. Once Venus is onto the disk, it's fully onto the disk, it kind of seems to slowly creep across, and it's kind of boring, and you can go off to other things, and, you know, have lunch, talk with the friends, come back, look in the telescope, and yep, it's moved along, right? Or you could decide that I'm going to take a picture of this every minute and then turn it into a movie or something. I might do that this time. Then you approach the third contact, and that's when the edge of Venus just begins touching the other side of the sun and starts coming off the disk. Those points of contact, first contact, second contact, when Venus is fully into the disk of the sun, third contact, when Venus is just touching the edge of the sun, a couple hundred years ago, those were insanely important times, believe it or not. It goes back to the fact that it was recommended or suggested by the same fellow who invented the Gregorian telescope, James Gregory. He realized that if you were looking at Mercury going across the face of the sun, and Mercury goes across the face of the sun a lot more often than Venus, partly because it's closer and goes around the sun faster, 86 days. He realized that if you could watch in time from different parts of the Earth a Mercury transit, perhaps you could work out how far away the sun is. Because we didn't used to know how far away the sun is. We knew from just observations from Earth, we could work out the orbital periods of all of the planets, how long they take to go around the sun. That was easy, relatively speaking. That was what Kepler mostly did. But we didn't know the precise distance from the Earth to the sun, and that in turn would allow us to scale, using Kepler's orbital laws, the entire solar system. How far away is everything, right? We didn't have that one key ingredient. And so James Gregory figured out that we could use Mercury. Trouble was, Mercury was actually a little too close to the sun to give you much accuracy. And clocks back then weren't all that great either. So atomic clocks. No CBC 1 o'clock time signal, right?
Right.
Anyway, so Horlock saw the transit. But it wasn't until Lalande in 1761 and 1769, he actually calculated a rough approximation for how big the solar system was based on his measurements of a transit.
I wonder if that's something that students could do.
Yeah, absolutely. But you'd have to cooperate with somebody else, okay? Because if you make a measurement from here, first of all, you won't see the whole transit. Unfortunately, the sun sets while the transit is going on from London, Ontario. Transit begins here about 1808, 8 minutes after 6 local time. And then the sun sets at about 8:30. Well, the transit's really only just got going. But if you go north and you go west, you'll see more of the transit. If you were in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, you're far enough north that you will see the whole transit because basically the sun doesn't set until very much after the transit is over. I'm going to Hawaii. Yeah, why not? I mean, let's make a choice between Hawaii or Yellowknife. Hard to choose, right? And I want to be
not
at Hawaii.
Not that we're knocking Yellowknife on.
Oh, I love Yellowknife. Yellowknife is a wonderful city. They're very keen on having tourists. And if you take your own accommodations, you shouldn't have a trouble because I understand the hotel rooms are going very fast in Yellowknife.
But for this event, really?
For this event, okay. Yes. Yellowknife also has the advantage of being fairly dry, and so they're less likely to have cloud, which is part of the reason why I want to be on the top of Mauna Kea. The top of Mauna Kea has less cloud, too, especially in June. I want to be there to watch at least the end of the transit, because even in Hawaii, and boy, is that ever far west, the transit ends, and then the sun sets a couple of minutes later. But I'll see the whole transit.
Is there a perfect place on Earth right now to go see the transit?
Tahiti.
That seems like a good place.
Tahiti's a good place, except it does tend to be cloudy in the middle of the day. But, you know, you take your chances, right? Clouds do move. Australia, perhaps. I personally think Hawaii is going to be the perfect place. And so that's what my plan is, yeah. Basically, what I'm saying is I've seen one transit in whole, and now I want to see the next in that series. The interesting thing is that transits come in pairs, 8 years apart, and they occur in June. And then the next pair of transits, 121 and a half years, ooh, a half year, ooh, that means it's not happening in June, it's happening in December. The interesting thing about transits too, especially in the 17th and 18th centuries, Edmund Halley recommended highly, don't use Mercury to figure out the AU, use Venus. And he worked out when the next transit was going to be.
For our listeners, what's an AU?
Astronomical unit, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. About 150 billion meters. When Halley figured out that this was an important way to measure the AU, gosh, there were all sorts of scientists going all over the world looking to try to make accurate observations of the transit of Venus. I mean, that's one of the reasons why James Cook went off on his voyage. And James Cook went to Tahiti to observe the transit of Venus, and he got clouded out. So he puttered around the South Pacific and went back to Tahiti to a place now called Venus Point. And so he went back and did observe the transit. The disappointing thing is that because Venus has an atmosphere and because Earth has an atmosphere, it makes the image of Venus scintillate, jiggle around a little bit in the telescope. And it can't be avoided, unless you were in space and got rid of the atmosphere or something. And so consequently, you can't tell precisely when Venus is at second contact. There's a little time, it's about a minute and a half, where Venus appears to still be stuck on the edge of the solar disk. There's what's called the black teardrop effect. You see this little dark banding between Venus's disk and the edge of the Sun. Well, is it in contact or isn't it? And the whole trick to getting better accuracy with the transit method relied upon getting a very, very clean time of when the two disks were at that point of tangency. So everybody was kind of disappointed with what they saw. So that meant that our measurements of the astronomical unit were in quite dire straits for a long time. We've now got excellent measurements of the Sun's distance to an accuracy of about 30 meters. And we can't get much better than that because the atmosphere of the Sun boils. You know, it's constant motion, so it's up and down and up and down. You know, bouncing radar off the Sun is one method of getting a very precise measurement. Arecibo can do that easily. Also, just monitoring spacecraft as they go around the solar system. And we know the position and distance of the spacecraft, and we know its orbit with precise accuracy. We know its mass with precise accuracy. We can work out where the center of the spacecraft orbit is. Therefore, we were able to measure the accuracy to just a few meters. But that took modern techniques. And when you look back at what they did with their transit measurements, pretty good, actually. You know, they got in the right order of magnitude anyway.
Which is actually pretty incredible given the technology they had at the time, right, with the telescopes they had.
Well, they're using pendulum clocks synchronized off the transit of Io's shadow on Jupiter and things like that, you know. Now, you look at a transit of Venus and you go, yeah. I mean, in Crete, I was thinking, yeah, I am now seeing what people haven't seen for 121 years.
Right.
Or actually, it was 105.5 years. Seeing something this summer that people won't see for 121 and a half years.
So if people are looking at watching the transit, can you describe what it might look like?
First of all, the Sun is only a half a degree across.
So it's about the size of your thumb if you hold it out.
If you hold your hand out full, it's actually smaller than the end of your thumb. I mean, maybe your little fingernail or something,
okay.
You know, but you can cover up the Sun with your thumb for sure. But the Sun's pretty darn big, and Venus is really tiny by comparison. If you see Venus, it's a little, tiny, absolutely black speck, like a pencil mark. So it is really tiny. I've typically used a telescope running about 30 or 40 power, just a small refractor, because, of course, the Sun's pretty big. You don't need a big telescope.
Right, you don't want to zoom in too far, because you might miss Venus floating by, depending on how big your telescope is.
Well, that's right. I mean, you want a moderate amount of power. 40 or 50 power is about optimum. Because the lower the power, unless your telescope's got a clock drive, you'll have to reposition the telescope every once in a while. If
right.
you're running high power, you've got to reposition the telescope every couple of seconds, right?
Right?
Very annoying. people will look in the eyepiece and go, oh, there's Venus. And then the next person could look, and then the next person could look. You're not having to move the telescope so often. And you still see this nice little black disk. The other thing which puzzled me greatly was that Venus looked bumpy to me when I looked in the telescope. And then I realized that the bumpiness was the seeing of the Earth's atmosphere. It was making the disk of Venus wiggle a little tiny bit. It was shimmering, if you will. And that, of course, makes timing when it touches the edge of the disk very difficult. I'm really quite keen on seeing Venus from the top of Mauna Kea because I'm going to be above a lot of the atmosphere. And I'm expecting to be a whole lot sharper.
So I'm hoping that you will be taking photos and video of this.
I do have decent cameras. So the idea is I'm going to have a camera on a telephoto lens with a solar filter, and I'll be shooting with that. And then I will have another camera that I will occasionally look into the eyepiece of a properly filtered telescope. So I'll be able to occasionally shoot what's called a focally. And anybody can do this. I mean, we have students all the time with their iPhones at the Cronin taking pictures through the eyepiece of Jupiter or Saturn or the moon. And that's how I took pictures of Venus last time. The nice thing about a transit is it takes a long time. Remember, it's going to take about 6 hours. So if you're having difficulties, there's enough time to correct. The other thing I'm really looking forward to this transit is that the sun is now a lot more active in terms of sunspots.
That's right.
Than it was in 2004.
Yeah, it's kind of at a peak in its activities.
Yeah, getting close. I hope it's at a peak, or it's coming towards a peak anyway. And last time, there were two little teeny-weeny sunspots on the disk of the sun. This time, I'm hoping that I have difficulty picking out Venus from the sunspots. I mean, that would be wonderful. You bet I'll come back with some pictures. Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, maybe we can post them on the Western World's website so people can take a look.
Well, we'll put a link on because I think they'll be on the London Center website.
Okay.
www.rasclondon.ca.
So do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share about the transit or any final tips for people who want to view it?
Well, I know that there's going to be some activity here on campus.
There is, yes. We're planning to do a public event, obviously on the night of June 5th, right?
Yeah.
The transit starts at about 6 p.m.
Just a little after 6 p.m. and then goes to sunset.
So we'll have telescopes set up for anyone who wants to come out and check it out. And they're going to be doing live video streaming from Mauna Kea, actually.
Yeah.
And so if people are in horrible locations with horrible weather, right, like we might be in, at least you can still see it.
I know that there's going to be, as well, an event up in Goderich. Goderich has a very nice little park right in downtown that looks out over Lake Huron. And it's an ideal spot to watch the sun right to the horizon. But I would encourage people to consider, you know, going to Yellowknife or meeting me on Mauna Kea.
So if you can get out there to see it with your own eyes, yeah, and do it.
Even content yourself with you're not going to see the end of the transit. The end of the transit is just the beginning of the transit run backwards.
Right.
And we'll have the sun quite high for the beginning of transit, 45, 46 degrees, something like that. But the end of the transit, of course, the sun is buried in the dirt for us here in Ontario. So even just see the beginning of it, just through a solar filter. I know RASC is getting 150 or so solar glasses to hand out.
The CPSX is also getting, I think, 500 or something like that.
Yeah.
So we'll conglomerate all of them together, whoever comes out can get a pair.
If people have solar glasses that they've used maybe in the past for the annular eclipse, or if they've got, you know, access to something, you know, like a welder's filter, they'll be able to see the transit. They'll be able to see Venus on the sun. And they can say, aha, people are not going to see this for 121 and a half years. That's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I think it's important to be a part of it.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
We just listened to Alyssa Gilbert with Dave McCarter about the upcoming transit of Venus that's going to occur on the evening of June 5th. They talked about how to observe the transit and some of the historical observations of Venus, such as using transit to get a more accurate measurement of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Since we here at CPSX are into the exploration side of things, we might want to expand on some of the more recent observations.
Well, I know the Russians have been fairly successful. They're the only ones who've returned pictures from the surface, as it turns out.
It's hard, so good for them. They made it, and it's not easy to pull that off.
Oh, it's incredibly hard. Their probes literally sweated lead. They had a lead-based cooling system with a heat sink of solid lead, which slowly melted, because it's hot enough on the surface of Venus to melt lead. And as the lead melted, that protected the electronics which is surrounded, and then it dribbled down in a little puddle under the spacecraft. And the camera lenses, due to the heat and pressure, they couldn't use glass. Glass would melt as well. So they actually used diamonds. Artificial diamonds.
Even so, they're only able to get a couple of frames back, even just fractions of a frame, before the lander failed, and that was it. Now, less well known, the Russians also had a balloon mission. We've now had the Americans, who've managed to surveil the surface with the Magellan orbiter back in the early 90s, and Venus Express with the Europeans is there now.
Yeah, and Venus Express has been particularly successful with sort of a different sort of radar sounding than Magellan did. But it's the only probe that we've got in orbit there right now. And it's, it's particularly useful to look at Venus up close because we can't see anything from a distance with those thick clouds.
That's right. So the radar technology makes a big difference, as you're saying. But we can tell some things from very far away. One of the interesting things that I noted when I was researching for this was that one of the first detections of Venus having an atmosphere comes from one of these transits, and the particular way that that dot looks as it goes across the sun.
Yeah, absolutely. And that atmosphere actually is a major defining characteristic of how Venus behaves. It seems to be strong enough even to influence the rotation of the planet.
Which basically is non-existent. It's slower than its year and goes the wrong way around, and this is believed to be due to the incredibly strong winds essentially sapping the angular momentum of the planet.
Well, that can be part of it, but I think the bigger story there is probably something we like to call spin orbit coupling. I mean, something that came up in the interview was actually the fact that Venus and Earth are in some ways kind of synced up in terms of their rotations, their orbits, and you can share angular momentum around the solar system through these kinds of couplings. And what's really interesting is that the math gets a little complicated, but you can explain some very strange things. Like, you can explain the tilts of planets, you can explain the rotation rates, and there's even this theory with Uranus that it must have had a large impact to knock it on its side. Well, it looks like maybe you don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, the interesting, with Venus, this very, very slow rotational period, we thought we had understood what that period was, and just a few weeks ago, based on Venus Express data, suggests that that rotation is either different than we thought or non-constant. They did some imaging of the surface with the radar on Venus Express, and they found that the surface features that they were able to map and line up with the Magellan data were tens of kilometers away from where they should have been, suggesting either the planet's rotation has not been constant or that something else is going on.
We certainly know a lot less about Venus than we do about places such as Mars.
I think one of the main key reasons for that is probably the thick atmosphere that one needs to, not have on Mars or Moon. And I think one of the interesting pictures that I've seen is called the Noodle Picture from Magellan spacecraft, which essentially is called by the geologists because of the rifts and valleys they see on the surface of the Venus, which they weren't expecting.
Yeah, one of the weirdest things when we actually got to see the whole surface for the first time, this with the Veneras, we only saw little pieces. But when we got to see the whole surface with Magellan, it's astoundingly young surface. It's no more than 500 million years old. So what's going on with this place?
Yeah, how could there be so few impact craters, and what is it that is perhaps resurfacing that planet?
Now, part of the story, because Venus is so large, is probably things like tectonics that we have on the Earth. And so ideas have been floated, including a complete resurfacing about a half billion years ago. But we still don't really know, and one of the things that really makes tectonics, plate tectonics, work well on Earth is the presence of water. On Venus, that stuff's all gone.
Without the water, either there's two competing theories. Either it's completely seized up, and then, as you say, every half billion years or so explodes and completely resurfaces. Or that there aren't tectonic plates as such, only tiny flakes compared to what's on Earth, which leads to sort of hypertectonicism. Unfortunately, we haven't been observing Venus continuously enough to see if there's a lot of sort of active volcanoes. We know there's volcanoes. We've seen them. We don't know how active they are currently. If they are active, that would imply a more active tectonic system than the seized up model, which is something hopefully having the Venus orbiter and NASA's next planned mission will be able to nail down.
It's an exotic place. I mean, you look at places like the Ishtar Plateau with Maxwell Montes, there doesn't seem to be a good model that can explain how those mountains get so high and get held up there. And then when you look at the radar signatures, there's something very, very reflective, maybe even a metal that's deposited on some of these peaks at specific altitudes.
Well, there's absolutely no reason there wouldn't be metals. It's there's no oxygen in the atmosphere. It's very hot, and it's CO2. And this is the sort of reducing environment we use on Earth to get metal out of rock. And so there's no reason the mountain couldn't have had some metallic raw metal sweated out of it from various ores, which is incredibly fascinating in its own way. But incredibly useless for anyone who wants to go mining Venus, because, again, our best bet on the surface was, what, an hour almost? Not even.
Like, if you want a more modern example, using more modern technology, there was a proposal in the last New Frontiers cycle called SAGE, which was a Venus lander, and it was going to land in two spots. It was going to touch down, take some measurements, and then very quickly jump to another spot, take some more measurements. And I think its lifetime, it was quite short. It was on the order of hours, and that was it.
But, I mean, you have this very high surface temperature in hundreds of degrees. Pressures on the order of 100 times what you see at the surface of the Earth. Sulfuric acid rain and violent winds and lightning. So it's hard to make any kind of machine work in that environment, and hours would be impressive.
Sure. The nice thing is once you get to the surface, then the winds get calmer. Mm-hmm. But in the upper atmosphere, Venus is super rotating, and so it's a violent place. This is one of the great things about Venus Express, which we should mention is essentially a copy of Mars Express.
That's right.
So it was kind of done a little bit on the cheap, or shall we say it was a good, efficient, economical use of existing technology, put together by last week's guest, actually, David Southwood. Well, he was head of robotic exploration at ESA. But we've had now this question of the rotation rate. We've seen Aurora. There's still lots of stuff to be learned about this place.
Yeah, Aurora was not at all expected because Venus lacks a strong or hardly any measurable magnetic field. On Earth, the aurora are created by the magnetic field funneling particles from the solar wind in towards the poles. So without that funneling effect, it's actually quite surprising that there's a measurable, and I don't think anyone really expected it.
And I think what makes Venus really interesting is the fact that among the rocky planets, other than Earth, it's the only planet that probably has a substantial amount of atmosphere, hence it can be a testbed to test our theories all about atmospheres.
Yeah, and they've been using Venus Express actually to study the upper layers of that atmosphere in a novel way. Venus Express is designed, in short, as a sort of box containing the instruments and the engine with a pair of solar array panels on either side of the spacecraft, and they're able to rotate those. They've been actually using it as a sort of wind vane system to pass through the atmosphere. They set one panel flat against the direction of travel and one at an angle, and based on how much rotation the atmosphere imparts as the thing passes through the tenuous upper atmosphere, they can actually make guesses about how thick the atmosphere is up there. And no one had ever tried that kind of atmospheric investigation before, but they're able to do that with Venus Express.
For all the other orbiters that have gone to Mars and to Venus, we've only had that one point from the aerobraking. Mm-hmm. So it's at one point, at one depth. But to be able to do it continuously is a neat thing.
In so much as it is going to shorten the orbital life of the spacecraft and lead to its inevitable fiery demise.
Yeah, the spacecraft isn't going to last forever anyway, right? No. So you make your choices about what science you get out of it.
It's true. But it is an interesting place. It seems these thick atmospheres, a lot of them have this cloud, this air of mystery. Titan, which we will hear about a little bit next week, is the other body in the solar system, rocky body, or in that case, icy, that has a thicker atmosphere than the Earth.
But it's also interesting that as far as terrestrial planets go, it's one of the ones that's very poorly known. Right? We've been talking about, is there tectonism, and how does it form, and how does the resurfacing happen? We have a very small set of models of how terrestrial planets behave, and we spend all of our time living on one of them, which seems to be kind of special in the way it's set up. And Venus, we still don't really understand how it works.
That's true. The one thing we seem to know is that Edgar Rice Burroughs was wrong when he thought that... Underneath those clouds were giant jungles and carboniferous monsters.
Well, with the data at the time, it was a perfectly reasonable supposition. They knew there was an atmosphere. They knew there was CO2 in it, but they didn't know how much. So they could postulate a reasonable greenhouse effect, which would give us a nice tropical climate across the planet. But clouds, well, we didn't have that sulfur signature out of it. So why couldn't they be water?
Yeah, it's easy to make vast speculations on half-vast data, and we're still kind of doing that with Venus. We have a pretty good idea now that there aren't jungles, but there's still a lot of things we don't know about. How is, you know...
I think we have successfully ruled out the jungles.
The jungles, yes. Yeah, those are probably not there.
Well, enjoy the mystery when you watch the transit of Venus. Only the seventh time in recorded history it's taking place.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and John Moores. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forrester. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm. For those of you interested in going out to observe, there are two fantastic online resources for the upcoming Venus transit. Transitofvenus.org has wonderful information about where, when, and how to safely observe the transit, the history of the event, and links to resources, such as a free smartphone app which allows individuals to send in their observations. NASA's Sun Earth Day website, sunearthday.nasa.gov, has a map of all the registered events around the world, great videos and podcasts, and will also hold a live webcast from the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. For our listeners who live in London, Ontario, the CPSX, in partnership with the Department of Physics and Astronomy and the local chapter of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, will be hosting an event for the Venus transit on June 5th. The doors to the Hume Cronin Observatory on the Western University campus will open at 5:30 p.m., and observing will continue through sunset and beyond. For more information, please go to physics.uwo.ca and click on the Cronin Observatory link on the right-hand side. The transit of Venus is amongst the rarest astronomical phenomena and won't happen again until the year 2117, so prepare now, and don't miss out on this extremely special event.